This is Scenic Roots, talking writing. Our guest is poet, naturalist, and essayist, Ray Zimmerman.
The dance of leaves. The breeze stirred every leaf on the tree. They shifted hues as the gentle wind flipped them this way and that. Dressed in autumn colors, they prepared to fall, but time declared that they would have a few more days. I imagined how Henry David Thoreau might have nodded and written a thoughtful essay. Thoreau was not there. Nor was Walt Whitman, who might have danced with the leaves, turning one way and then another. He would celebrate their electric bodies and their changing colors in a carnal proclamation of all humanity. St. Francis might have rung a bell, as he is said to have done for the rising moon. Startled citizens of Assisi left their beds to come running in search of a fire. They went home angry when he explained that it was only the moon. They grumbled, as did neighbors of Van Gogh when his madness became unbearable. He might have painted those leaves on canvas, surrounding each leaf with swirls of color to simulate the motion in the style of his Starry Night. I could not imagine what Terry Tempest Williams, spokeswoman of desert canyons where trees are few and far between, might say. She might have searched the tree for evidence of an owl's nest or remembered cottonwoods swept away in a flash flood. She might have used them as a metaphor for recent losses in the world of conservation. The loss of most of the Bears Ears National Monument prompted her to contemplate undoing and write a book titled Erosion. Annie Dillard would likely pick a single leaf to examine. She might describe how the vein structure resembled a network of trails through the woods, the spots indicating that some decomposer was already at work on the leaf would certainly get her attention, just as a deflating frog at Tinker Creek once moved her to an intricate essay that only gave us the cause at the end. She lived in a cabin on Tinker Creek, and Edward Abbey once christened her the heir to Thoreau. I shot a video that did not do justice to the leaves and their changing colors. I wished I could see the world with the eye of one of the great thinkers and felt desolation for my humble craft. Then I remembered an old friend who said that imagination is the most powerful of nations. I traveled widely in that nation. The first stop was easy. I rang a bell in celebration of St. Francis. The second step required time travel. I became a fly on the wall of Van Gogh's room and watched him painting his Starry Night. At Walden Pond, I became a kingfisher. Thoreau paused from hoeing his rows of beans and nodded. Perhaps he was contemplating trips on the nearby river or out to Cape Cod. Then I flew down to New York. Whitman did not notice me as he swam among the bathers. I wondered which edition of his one great book of poems he was working on. I wished I had read his prose work, Specimen Days, as well as Leaves of Grass. I journeyed to the Red Rock Desert of the American West and took the form of a raven. High on a bluff, I saw Terry Tempest Williams instructing some desert writers. After making a particularly powerful point, she howled like a coyote as described in her book, An Unspoken Hunger. In the form of a heron, I saw Annie Dillard at Tinker Creek. A frog in the stream deflated exactly as described in her book. The attacking giant water bug swam away. Imaginings completed, I returned to the tree. Days had elapsed. The leaves had fallen.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ray. Our guest is Ray Zimmerman, poet, and as you can tell from that, essayist. So I thought it might be kind of fun to just wander through this essay and the heroes that you've identified.
Sure.
So, should we start with Walt Whitman?
Walt Whitman, yeah. I guess Walt Whitman is the convenient answer when people ask, where did free verse come from? Because he established free verse in America, although he was probably influenced by a French form called verse libre, which means free verse. So he may have known about that, but his work was not well received when he first published it. One critic suggested that he go hang himself. Another said that it was like an explosion in a sewer. So, but after years of his writing being around and promotion, it actually got popular pretty quickly. It did not achieve what he thought it would achieve, because he wrote a lot about workmen and common people, and he pictured people reciting that poem as they went out to hoe their bean field and plow their land, and that didn't happen, but it did catch on.
What did he think that they would take from his poetry?
Just the fact that he was an everyday poet, and he celebrated the life of the common man.
So he wanted to
and woman.
Sort of elevate them a little bit in their minds by elevating them on the page.
Yeah, and he was very big on equality of genders. You know, he said, and he talks about man, and he says, and woman too, and goes through more about why women are important. And
it's pretty cool, you know. I mean, it may not be relevant, but he was gay, right?
Right.
I don't know if that made him more or less sensitive.
Either gay or bisexual, nobody's really sure, but that may have played into that answer, into his answer to what life is all about, which is what any poet is doing.
What drew you to Walt Whitman?
His free verse and just the common people. The common people.
Was that your first exposure to free verse when you read his stuff?
I think so. Maybe not, but I think so. It impressed me because the first time I read that book, Leaves of Grass, I thought it was just one long poem. Mm. I didn't realize that there were several poems there. But it does read as if it were all one long piece of one long cloth. I celebrate myself a single solitary person. That's a very important statement to me. We all have to come to terms with who we are, and we have to celebrate that, and then we see where we go from there.
I like the idea that we contain multitudes too.
Every person contains multitudes.
There's some comfort in that, you know?
In some cases, that's diagnosed as an illness. That's when they let them all come out at different times, though, I guess.
I guess we do tend to privilege self-discipline in that sense, don't we?
It's hard to separate him from Thoreau, because Thoreau influenced me early on with his essays. Civil Disobedience, and I really liked his book Cape Cod more than Walden, and that one was not published during his lifetime. His sister posthumously published it, but they were of the same era, and both would have amounted to less than what they amounted to if it had not been for Emerson, who continuously said, we need an American art form in literature. We need to stop imitating those Europeans. We aren't Europeans anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because it seems to me that Whitman particularly is quintessentially American.
Yeah.
The energy in his writing and the expansiveness.
Yeah. His first poem in Leaves of Grass goes on for 80 pages. And I can almost picture him reading the whole thing in one breath. it just doesn't stop. It just keeps going and going.
He's like a 19th century version of Jack Kerouac in some ways.
In some ways. He was a great hero to the beat poets, I believe.
I can see why, yeah.
Particularly Ginsberg. He wrote a poem about Whitman. maybe because they were both gay. I don't know that that could have played in.
Well, I think they probably had a philosophical commonality too, didn't they?
Yeah. And I think the thing I like about Whitman is he just celebrates. He celebrates life, and he celebrates
very positive
the people, and he celebrates the land. And the land is central to my ethos and being.
Well, among the various titles that you have, one calls you a park ranger and a naturalist.
Which I've been, yeah. Yeah, I've worked.
In some ways, that seems to me to be at the center of who you are. That everything you do, you know, whether it be vice president of the Writers Guild or the freelance journalism that you do, the essays that you write, your poetry, it all seems to be much of you, as you've just said about Whitman, a kind of celebration of the natural world.
Yeah, the natural world. Without the landscape, I would be very lost. Mm-hmm. You know, if I ever someday have to move into a retirement home, I hope there's windows.
So do I. Okay. I can't imagine. That's rather like putting a wild bird in a cage.
Yeah, I'd say so. I didn't, in that essay, mention any of the haiku poets, but I count them as influence, particularly Basho. His book, Narrow Road to the Interior, is just, it's, as he says, in tune with the four seasons. And it's very nature, it's nature poetry. I think he wrote what's considered the quintessential haiku in the 17th century. Old pond, a frog jumps in, the sound of water.
It is a lot like those Japanese pen and ink paintings, isn't it? Just the essence, just the yeah. There's so much you can fill in just from those images.
Yeah, and in fact, as an author, Stephen Addist wrote a book called The Art of Haiku, and he includes not just the poems, but artwork done by those haiku masters, because a lot of them did a drawing to accompany a haiku. Now, the combined form is called haiga. And it's the drawing is done with the same calligraphy pen that was used to write the haiku. As we break a haiku into three lines in Japanese, it's one vertical line. And so there's plenty of room on the other side of the page to make a drawing.
Well, one of the things, one of the aspects of your essay that I particularly like is, and maybe it's because I know you're a poet, that it reads as a poet writing prose. And in common with the haiku writers, I think that poetry is the art of distilling something to the essence.
And making sure that it has a specific rhythm to it. And well-written essays have to be rhythmic, too.
There's almost stanzas in this essay with, you know, each personality is a new start in some sense.
I didn't do it as a poem. I have written some poems that have morphed into essays. But
what about the other way around?
Occasionally. I wrote an essay about a rattlesnake once that turned into a poem. It was eventually published as a poem.
It seems to me that maybe that's the easier way to go than the other way, where you start with a poem and then try to expand it to an essay. It seemed to me that you've already said all you wanted to say in the poem, so how would you expand it, except by adding more detail, I guess?
Yeah, I don't know. Someone said poems are never finished, just abandoned. I think that was a famous French poet that said that. I can't remember his name.
That would seem to stand for any creative work, you know?
Yeah, but I guess when a poem turns into an essay, I finish it and realize that it was an essay all along. You know, I read it and it doesn't read like a poem. It reads like prose with line breaks. That's not poetry. So it has to be prose.
I think that's why many of us find writing poetry so challenging.
Knowing where to put the line breaks is essential.
And how to distill your ideas into such, you know, sharp and clearly delineated images, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's hard to do.
So, yeah. Well, we talked about a couple of my heroes.
We did. I was coming to St. Francis. Aside from the obvious connection, I was wondering what it was about St. Francis that drew you.
One of his pieces called The Canticle of Brother Sun. And it's just a continuous hymn of praise, but he's grabbing images out of nature. He says, "Praise be you, our Father, through our brother Sun, and sister Moon, and sister Mother Earth, who sustains and governs us." That kind of writing, those images just appealed to me.
Mm. So romantic.
I suppose so. There are some theologians who say that all nature praises the Creator, and some who say that all of creation groans for renewal, and I tend to agree with them. I don't think there's a writer that's anything like St. Francis since he put pen to paper.
And that was what, 12th century?
Something like that. Yeah. Way back. I heard he walked to the Vatican through the snow in bare feet. That's not something I want to replicate.
Me either.
Yeah. I think Van Gogh, I think I just threw him in there because of the swirling motion in that picture, Starry Night.
Yeah, I was wondering about poor old Vincent, and you talk about, you know, how his neighbors, in fact, for that matter, his brother, responded to him as he became more and more, I don't know what the word is exactly, sort of out of touch. I don't think he was necessarily nuts, but I think he was...
Well, it's interesting.
Stressed.
Because he continued to paint while he was in the asylum.
Mm.
Yeah, which I suppose he found a solution that worked for him there. I don't know how well it worked. I think what I've read, his life sounds like it was painful. And then I put in two moderns, and they are heroes of mine. Annie Dillard and Terry Tempest.
Well, before we leave Vincent van Gogh, it strikes me that's almost like painted poetry.
Mm. It could be. Mm. Yeah. I can't say anything more about that. It sounds like an interesting idea, though.
Terry Tempest Williams is perhaps, of all the people you reference in this essay, the one with the... who doesn't have as wide, perhaps, reputation as some of the others?
Perhaps, although she's published a lot of books.
I guess it's my ignorance. You know, I don't know anything about I don't know very much about naturalist writers. That's probably part of the reason for that.
Nature writers are a whole group apart, and yeah, she is almost entirely in that school. Some of her work is political in an environmentalist sense.
She's from Utah?
Yeah, she's from Utah, and some of her work is political in terms of rebelling against the Mormon Church, of which her father was an elder. That had to be an interesting family because she's teaching at the University of Utah, teaching in the environmental humanities program, and she was a naturalist at the State Museum of Natural History. Her dad was a third generation pipeline contractor, and her brothers all worked in the family business.
So she's a bit like a Yankee in the court of King Arthur.
Yeah, well, they must have had some interesting discussions.
I can't imagine to be surrounded with people who are so philosophically opposed to everything that you write about and that you care about, you know?
Well, sort of. But, I mean, her brothers and her dad were all outdoors people, hunters, fishermen, hikers. So they had some points of commonality. But I think
so there's this kind of pragmatic, poetic balance in her family.
I suppose. I wasn't there, so I can't say for sure.
Is she a contemporary of yours?
She's probably close age-wise, yeah.
Which I guess is true of Annie Dillard also.
Yeah, I think so. It's interesting to think about that. I read them as role models, but mm-hmm. they're probably in close to my age, maybe younger.
Well, Annie Dillard, I guess, has in common with Thoreau that she's from New England, right?
Yeah, and she writes a bit about nature, but she's really considered philosophical, theological, particularly not her book. Well, her book Pilgrim at Tinker Creek is, but more so the next couple of books after that, Teaching a Stone to Talk. and I can't remember the title of that short one. It's all about fire, though, and people. And one person who was burned in a fire and a moth that got caught in a candle flame. And I was wondering where she was going with that, but it ends well.
Are you attracted to her spirituality?
I like any spirituality in writing. Hers is a different variety than my own. My own tends to be more traditional.
You're a Protestant?
Pardon?
Are you a Protestant?
Yeah, Methodist. So, I'm probably, a little out on the edge for my fellow Methodists, but you come to terms with what you believe, and that's that.
Well, I wanted to open the conversation, as I said, by, using your essay as a way for you to talk about what you do, and if it's okay with you, we'll take the second half of the conversation and concentrate on your poetry. And mm-hmm. if you'd like to read some of your poetry, we can talk about it.
That sounds delightful.
Well, I tell you what, we have enough time today for one poem. You care to read one.
Yep. Okay. Okay. This is Sonnet 3. I've written 3 sonnets, and this is the third one. So does the drought give birth to quenching rain, as heat of day recedes with cooler night. The Arctic bear from northern sky takes flight. With darkness ended, sun must rise again. The turquoise sky aflame with salmon red, as clouds leap fish-like from the eastern rim. Across the watery sky we see them skim. When evening comes, the turquoise blue has fled. As thirsty people cry for quenching rain, the leaves of trees like paper scorched by sun, the heat-parched winds must cross the dusty plain, dry ferns uncurl like newfound life begun, the soul revives where once despair had lain, and seeds shall sprout as life must have its run.
Back to what you were talking about before, the endless cycle, huh?
Well, yeah, I wrote that near the beginning of the COVID epidemic, or pandemic, I should say. And I think people need hope. So it talks about despair and it talks about hope. Hope is always with us. I think that was published in the Avocet, which is a small, little-known literary journal out of Fountain Hills, Arizona.
I think for many people, the pandemic has been an opportunity to reinvent, to, you know, think about all of the things that we take for granted and not to stretch the metaphor too much, but the notion of rebirth, in some sense, this pandemic seems almost Darwinian.
Yeah, that could be. It could be. It's been interesting how poetry has changed. Sales of poetry books almost universally depend on readings, and you can't do public readings now, and you can't do open mics, except now they've gone online. So, you know, the Chattanooga Writers Guild has an open mic that's not limited to poetry. There's fiction and prose, fiction and nonfiction prose. So, and those are recorded and put on the Facebook page so people can hear them later and people can hear about your book and possibly buy it. The good side, the upside to that is that I have met more poets in other parts of the world over the past few months than I had met in the rest of my lifetime. I participate in one open mic that's organized by a person up in Nashville. It used to take place in a coffee shop, so it was called Poetry in the Brew. And now Poetry in the Brew is an online open mic with participants in Los Angeles and Arizona and Nashville and Chattanooga and Maine and the UK and a couple in Australia where it's tomorrow morning. So, you know, it's all, you know, I would never have been heard by poets in those other locations. And I would never have heard their work. And I participate in another one that's now that's based out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. So I've heard a lot of work by Wyoming and Colorado poets and West Coast. There are some West Coast folks in that one. So it's interesting that, you know, there's becoming this network.
I think it's one of the major upsides of something that's been a universal curse. There's not anybody on the planet, it seems, at this point, who hasn't been touched by this pandemic, you know. If we might, I'd like to continue our conversation next week. Our guest is naturalist, poet, and essayist, Ray Zimmerman. This is Scenic Roots, Talking Writing.